are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 6, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Andrew Bacevich, author of The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. Also on the program today, the Iraqi Prime Minister claims Soleimani was in Iraq for mediation between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Meanwhile, the Iraqi parliament calls for the U.S. exit. And Iran reduces its nuke deal commitments and threatens retaliation. In Europe, our European allies dump Trump as he threatens war crimes on Twitter. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee wants a Suleiman notice declassified and the House to vote on new war powers resolution. Meanwhile, the CBP, Customs and Borders Patrol, now stopping and questioning Iranian Americans at the U.S. border. And when they return tomorrow, Pelosi and the Democrats have made no decision on sending articles of impeachment. All this in the wake of disclosure of their existing 20 undisclosed OMB emails. The Hofeller drives are live. The GOP's gerrymander granddaddy tells secrets from the grave. And Guaido gets Guaidoed as Maduro backs a new parliamentary speaker. Trump's EPA rollback will destroy protections for 81% of streams in the southwest of this country. And U.S. manufacturing falls to its lowest level in a decade. The Fed blames Trump's tariffs. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. These Hofeller, I don't want to forget about this. The Hofeller drives. I've mentioned these in the past. Hofeller was that Republican who came up with the, among other things, he was the founding father of the modern version of gerrymandering the Republicans have embarked upon. And he was the one who was pushing for the census to ask the question about citizenship and had run models showing that in Texas it would help a Republican Party and white candidates immensely. And we know that because he died and apparently was estranged from his daughter, who was cleaning up his stuff and looked at one of the drives, and all the drives had all this information. And so the Republicans have been trying to keep this information under wraps. And she said, go screw yourself. I mean, I don't know if she said those exact words. She may have sworn. I don't know. And she has now released them. We will put the link to these drives in the podcast and YouTube descriptions.
Queen.
What? Absolutely. I closed the tab on. But what was the name of the site? I don't think this is HofellerFiles.com or Hofeller. And you can head over there. And I want to encourage our listeners to go there and check them out. If you see stuff that's interesting, send us an email with
them. Is it this one here? TheHofellerFiles.com?
Or at least Stephanie's coffee. Yeah, a copy. Yeah, now I guess. And there it takes you right to the drives. And you might as well just download that now that we're there.
I want details.
Yeah, exactly. Here's some details. Folks, go through those things.
And we should get like a hashtag or something for people to, if they find their own Hofiller Files discoveries, they can tag them.
Yeah. I guess, I don't know. I mean, Hofiller Files would be a good hashtag. But send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com if you find anything that you think might be interesting. I mean, people are going to be going over these with a fine-tooth comb because these are going to be the basis of lawsuits, I would imagine, going forward. They certainly, their existence certainly influenced the decision by the Supreme Court. I think when it came to the census question, it became very hard for them to argue that this was not racially motivated when the guy was clearly running an analysis and coming up with the results of like, this is really going to help white candidates and disempower Latinos. So we should do this. I mean, I don't think that was the exact phrasing, but I think it's pretty close, actually. So check that out. I want to make sure that everybody kept that sort of foreground, as it were. We got a lot to talk about on the program today. I marched across the bridge in New York, ostensibly like a solidarity anti-Semitism march. Although we will talk about Barry Weiss, sort of like, you know, I guess in some ways confusing that a little bit. But we will get to that later. We will also be talking about the new polls out showing Bernie Sanders now. I think the Real Clear Politics average has him in lead in Iowa and in New Hampshire.
Oh, hell yeah.
And we will talk a little bit about what we anticipate the implications of the assassination of Soleimani will mean to the elections. Julian Castro endorsed Elizabeth Warren, so his, you know, 2% of support may go to Warren. But I don't think people were terribly surprised about that, particularly based upon their almost identical Suleiman.
They're already sharing a spokesperson, apparently.
Yeah, we talked about that on Friday.
A tweet composer.
We were very fortunate to have just luckily had booked Andrew Bacevich. We wanted to talk to him about not the Pentagon Papers, the Afghanistan Papers and whatnot. And obviously there is more recent developments with our potential for a war going forward. There's a lot of different reporting that we're hearing about why Soleimani was in Iraq at the time. And of course, you know, what the fallout has been at this point. Nobody so far has really come up with a cohesive argument that there was even a strategy, never mind a bad strategy, that there was any strategy to this. And we commented on this on Friday. We had, we got this clip from Fox and Friends. Fox and Friends is still sort of like in overdrive. They're trying to catch up to this because on Friday, Brian Kilmeade. Now, you remember, why is Fox and Friends important? Because Fox and Friends is basically, their job is to tell the casual revanchivist, am I saying that right? Revanchist, the casual revanchist, you know, what to think, but needs to be done in such a way that it's like it is spoon-fed and pre-digested.
Almost understood non-verbally.
Exactly. And Brian Kilmeade on Friday was talking
expresses
about how...
Expresses for the non-verbal.
Yeah, exactly. Brian Kilmeade on Friday, you'll recall, was saying like, Qasem Soleimani was the evil, like the number one terrorist that America's been fighting. And we went back just to see if we could talk, see how much he's been talking about Soleimani over the years. And apparently he mentioned him once in early of 2018. Now, remember, Kilmeade has a radio show. I mean, he does like 6 hours of content a day. And for him to be ignoring the number one terrorist threat to Americans is really a disservice to all of us, I think. We had no idea. But aside from that, of course, you know, Soleimani was the general in charge of, in many respects, sort of coordinating all these franchisees of the proxy militias across the region, fighting in Iran and probably more narrow interests as well. And there has been an ongoing sort of proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and we have engaged in it on the Saudi side. But the they're working overdrive to try and sell this retroactively. And I think at the very least, and we'll talk to Basevich about this, it shows that this was like a very recent project. There's reporting that suggests Pompeo has been working on this for months, trying to convince Trump, and they finally have enough lunatics in key positions in the U.S. government where they all just sort of signed off and said, yeah, it's the obvious thing to do. But here is Fox and Friends explaining the, I guess that Trump has responded to the threats from the response from Iran.
Yes. Well, the president of the United States, now that everybody's back in session, they have the Senate impeachment trial. When Nancy Pelosi ever decides to give up the impeachment articles, is he in fact doing this, killing Soleimani, who's been on a terror list for about 10 years, and the Al-Quds force for longer than that? Was he actually doing this to distract from impeachment? Mm. Senator Elizabeth Warren thought about that and says, yeah, I think so.
Next week, the president of the United States could be facing an impeachment trial in the Senate. We know he's deeply upset about that. And I think people are reasonably asking, why this moment? Why does he pick now to take this highly inflammatory, highly dangerous action that moves us closer to war?
It was not just Elizabeth Warren, who, by the way, has fallen into fourth place in Iowa behind Buttigieg, and Biden, but also Buttigieg himself. He said yesterday that Soleimani was a bad guy, had blood on his hands, but the administration has failed to demonstrate why they had to do this operation right now.
It's so interesting that people are critical of the president's decisions, of our intelligence community's decisions, our generals' decisions.
They want detail.
General Tata said, well, they can't have it.
Yeah,
they
pause it for 1 second. I mean, what is this? Is I mean, just Ainsley Earhart, is that her name again? She this gets into like Escher painting qualities here. First off, the intelligence agencies and the generals did not make this decision. The White House itself said it was Donald Trump's decision. There is reporting supposedly that they gave him this option, and I guess subordinates to the three who showed up and gave him the option, which was Pompeo and Milley and Esper, the Raytheon executive. I'm sorry, the Secretary of Defense or the Raytheon executive. It really is. It doesn't matter. They rolled up in one. That subordinates were like, wow, can't believe he's doing this. That's the reporting. But there's no reporting that the general said, we're doing this. It wasn't the general's decision. It was the president's decision. And then the irony is that she's making up this story about all the people who are supposedly part of the deep state out to get Trump. And now they're the greatest defenders. They're
unquestionable.
Unquestionable again.
investigation right now.
It's so interesting that people are critical of the president's decisions, of our intelligence community's decisions, our general's decisions.
They want details.
General Tata said, well, they can't have it. They can't. Everything can't be made public. We heard Pompeo over the weekend saying everything that we have, the intelligence community has. He said, I ran the CIA at one point. We can't release everything. We can't release all of our intelligence information. We'll release as much as we can, but you just have to trust us, basically. And General Tata said it makes us more safe. He agreed with killing this general, this evil terrorist. He says it goes to show how ridiculous our divide is, that they support Soleimani over the president's decision. It counters everything that I learned as a soldier.
Just keep in mind,
Pause one second. They support Soleimani over the president's decision? I think that sort of misses what's going on here. But, I mean, it also explains to you why you always heard everybody say, like, he had blood on his hands. Because I've got to prove that I don't support Soleimani, a guy who nobody heard of before 3 days ago. I mean, obviously, people who...
You want details.
You want details. You can't have them. You can't have them. And there's a New York Times reporter... Rumani, I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but she said that in her reporting, she has found that just about everybody has said the idea that this guy Soleimani was even remotely close to sort of on the verge of like plotting or planning or executing an attack on U.S. military interests was reed thin, they said. And for those of you who do not play a wind instrument, the reed needs to be super thin so that when you blow, it makes a sound.
Well, think of the height of him being in a proxy war against the United States where he quote unquote killed Americans. It's called being in a proxy war. I wish none of us were doing any of these things, but it's like amazing how childish people are about this. Was like after the invasion of Iraq, which, I mean, Cheney and Bush didn't do this, and they did everything.
Here it is. It's Rukmini Kalamachi. I've had a chance to check with sources, including two U.S. officials who had intelligence briefings after the strike on Soleimani. This is after the strike. Here's what I've learned. According to them, I misspoke. She wrote, according to them, the evidence suggesting there was an imminent attack on American targets is razor thin. So not quite as thin as a reed.
It's thinner, but stronger.
Thinner, but stronger. In fact, the evidence pointing to that came as three discrete facts, a pattern of travel showing Soleimani was in Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq to meet with Shia proxies known to have an offensive position to the U.S. As one source said, that's just business as usual for Soleimani. More intriguing was B, information indicating Soleimani sought the Supreme Leader's approval for an operation. He was told to come to Tehran for consultation and further guidance, suggesting the operation was a big deal. But again, that could be anything. And the Iraqi prime minister has now at least publicly claimed that the reason why Soleimani was coming from Tehran
on a back commercial to Iraq flight.
On a commercial flight was because he was bringing a response to proposals that had come from Saudi Arabia to de-escalate. So all of that sort of is consistent with itself. Let's continue to listen here to Fox and Friends. We're sort of doing like that, this sort of high-low road with this, I guess.
Over the president's decision, it counters everything that I learned as a soldier.
Just keep in mind, if you're going to be critical of the president for not hitting Iran after they took out our drone, and not hitting Iran after they rocketed the Saudi oil bases, and not going after Iran after they were trying to mining the Gulf, you can also be critical of the president when he does take action in that area.
Our embassy.
Yeah, they go, well, how could the president let our embassy get breached and not do anything? Well, he does something, and these same people are going, oh, my God, how could the president do something?
Sure. And so why didn't...
Pause it for 1 second. First of all, I don't think it's the same people. I think he's wrong about that. Secondly, it's also not just do anything. It's just not do anything. It's do something that's not going to create a war, is I think what people are saying.
And so why didn't the president notify Congress before he hit? Do you think he really trusts the Democrats who are impeaching him right now? Mike Pompeo, who heard the criticism
from... Listen, one of the reasons why you consult a Congress is not because you get along with members of the other party. It's not like, you know, I want to maintain our friendship.
We're not talking to each other.
Yeah.
We're not on the best of terms right now.
I don't like them. And so, Constitution off.
I'm not invited to their round party.
Constitution off.
There's a famous Constitution overrider put in by John Jay called, if you're not getting along, you don't talk.
You don't do it. All right, just continue.
Mike Pompeo, who heard the criticism from Democrats who essentially are saying that the president did this thing over there in Iraq to, like the movie, wag the dog. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, says this about that. Watch.
Do you think that, as misguided as it may be, that some of our enemies think that this president is more vulnerable because of the impeachment effort?
You should ask Mr. Soleimani.
Not available for contact.
Good one. Snap. That actually doesn't address the question, which, of course, is, did he do this to distract from impeachment? I suspect we will get a better sense of that answer in the coming days. NBC News has now learned that John Bolton is willing to testify in the Senate impeachment trial if he's subpoenaed. That's going to put a lot of pressure, I think, on Mitch McConnell. As far as I can tell. So we will see going further. But before we get to Basevich, folks, I don't know if you know this about me, but I have never been the most stylish person. In fact,
yes,
Michael does. I think a
nice
lot of
shirt
people.
Today, though.
Well,
as I said, coming.
Well,
in.
I think if you have. If you have noticed, if you've paid attention, you've been watching me on the Sammy Cam back in the Air America days, where my motto was I spend more time prepping than primping, and to justify my lack of style. Well, you've seen an upgrade over the past year or so. Part of that, frankly, has been Stitch Fix. So, I mean, look at yourself in the mirror, folks. Describe your style in one word. I can describe mine. It was basically none. Low-key, I like to call it now. Low-key. But however you dress, stylists at Stitch Fix can help you find your new favorite piece. Stitch Fix, it's an online personal styling service that delivers your favorite clothing, shoes, accessories directly to you. First, what you do, you go in and you complete a style profile, and it's extensive. You get pictures. Do you wear your shirt like this? Would you ever wear an outfit like that? And there's like 20 different versions of all of that. And it's actually one like an image of your body. Do you have like too much around the gut maybe? Or are your thighs too big?
A woodworker meets Antonio Banderas. Exactly. Can you do that, please?
There you go. And there's actually, the options are incredible. And it lets you pick out the different types of brands that you use to. And what they do is there's no subscription. They also have kids boxes. So it's super easy if you don't know what to buy your kids. And you don't have to have a subscription. You can pick between automatic shipments or only getting new pieces on demand. And they send you suggestions. The shipping, the exchanges, the returns, they're always free. And they give you a $20. You got to pay for a $20 styling fee up front, but they apply that to your clothes down the road. So for me, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not getting hugely bold, but I'm finding now pants that don't have belt loops, which I think most people are consider to be an upgrade. At least it has helped my game, as it were. You know, single adult man shouldn't be wearing belt loops all the time, particularly when you're not carrying around a hammer. I just wear that now when I'm doing a little work. But
ladies.
I've got better shoes. What?
Hey, ladies.
There you go. Excuse right. me. I've gotten rid of the belt loop.
Hey, lady.
You can get a hammer. That's pretty cool.
There you go. That's right. And also, sometimes I wear pants that have like a little built-in hook for your impact driver. But that's another thing. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. Get an extra 25% off when you keep everything in your box. That's stitchfix.com/majority for an extra 25% off when you keep everything in your box. Check it out now, stitchfix.com/majority. I think also folks know in this office that Liquid IV is the go-to for when we're feeling like maybe we're catching a cold, or maybe we overdid it last night. Maybe too many people were in the studio for TMBS. So everybody, when they hit the booze, they also grab one of the Liquid IVs we've got over there. But now they've got something that I think is for me a daily drink. I started getting into matcha recently. I don't know why. It just tastes good. Yeah. Okay. Well, so half of Americans report they fight with daily fatigue. Everybody in here, I would say the same thing. Liquid IV Energy Multiplier gives you sustained energy throughout the day. It's a great all-natural alternative to processed energy drinks. The premium matcha and green energy blend tastes delicious, and it provides a lasting energy boost throughout the day. It's like a couple of cups of coffee without the crash. Liquid IV's Energy Multiplier contains a mixture of teas and herbs that are high in antioxidants. They help improve mood and focus without any artificial flavors or preservatives. The cellular transport technology delivers enhanced rapid absorption into the bloodstream, gives you a boost fast. As always, non-GMO, vegan, free of gluten, dairy, and soy. Around here, I travel with Liquid IV always. I've got it in both the apartments that I stay in because of my living arrangement. It is, I mean, for me, I like it because I'm not a big water drinker. You drink the Liquid IV, it hydrates you like two or three bottles of water. And the matcha, I love it. I need it. I'm tired all the time, folks. I don't know what to tell you. Get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MajorityRep at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order on Liquid IV's website. Go to liquidiv.com, enter the promo code MajorityRep, R-E-P, to save 25% and get better hydration and energy. Don't wait. Start fueling your adventures today. All right, quick break. And when we come back, Andrew Bacevich on the Age of Illusions. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. A pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University, the president of the Quincy Institute, Andrew Bacevich, author of his latest, The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Obviously, there's been a lot in the news that I would like to touch on, but let's just start with the broad strokes of your book. And I suspect that much of what has happened, not just in the last couple of days, but frankly in the past like a month or two with the release of the Afghanistan papers, further your premise. But you argue that In the fall, the end of the Cold War, and you credit George Herbert Walker Bush with having an impressive understanding of how the world worked, but an inability really to articulate any type of vision going forward, that American elites basically pushed a four major sort of, I guess, premises: globalized neoliberalism, a militarized hegemony, radical individual autonomy, and presidential command. Let's just talk about those and how we see those playing out. I mean, I think we talk a lot about globalized neoliberalism on this program, but let's talk a little bit about the militarized hegemony.
Yeah, and I think it's appropriate given the moment that we're in. In a nutshell, American elites, both civilians and military officers, persuaded themselves after the Cold War that we had become militarily supreme. The only other superpower had collapsed, and so from a military point of view, we were king of the hill and could do what we wanted. That led to, in my judgment, a dramatic transformation in the rationale for American military power. During the Cold War, the idea was to prevent World War III, to deter, to make sure that the Soviets didn't take over Western Europe. In the aftermath of the Cold War, the idea became to put American military power to work to fix problems. And that line of thinking was very much in evidence in the wake of 9/11, when the George W. Bush administration launched this global war on terrorism with enormously optimistic expectations of transforming much of the Islamic world. You know, fast forward to January of 2020, we're still stuck in that war. And we have a president who, having promised to get us out, seems to be getting us in that much deeper with the assassination of the past week as evidence of that.
Let me just question you a little bit on those. I understand the characterization of our military as being a bulwark against within the Cold War, but ultimately, isn't there a consistency between what we really looked for to our military to do then as we do now, which is to protect the financial interests of people who had the most amount of influence within this country? And how they would maintain those interests abroad?
I don't think I'd agree fully. It is certainly the case that the system, the way our system of governance is set up, it privileges the well-to-do. It helps to make sure that the people who are rich stay rich and get richer, and the well-being of the people who are not wealthy, who indeed in many respects are in need, tends to get treated as an afterthought. I don't know that that's central to thinking about the use of military power, but it does seem to be one of the overarching truths to our system. And indeed, again, referring back to this period after the Cold War ended, that occurred in spades. With all the enthusiasm about globalization and how that was going to make everybody rich, didn't make everybody rich. It made some people very, very, very rich indeed, but of course it exacerbated the gap between the rich and everybody else, so that gap is larger today than it's probably since it's ever been, certainly that it's been since the latter part of the 1800s.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking of, and maybe I'm thinking about the military too broadly, are things like the Kissinger, what was it, the 13, or the where we were projecting our power in Central America and Latin America because of corporate interests, or our involvement in the Middle East to a certain extent was also about at least maintaining oil or access to oil, or preventing others from getting access to oil, which I guess can be seen in a Cold War context, but also maybe that was this is what I'm asking it is was the that was the in part pretext of the day.
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I would certainly agree that if you want to know how why we ended up defining the Persian Gulf, the Middle East, as a vital U.S. national security interest, the one-word answer to that question is oil. So that trying to ensure the continued flow of oil from the Persian Gulf has been the overarching rationale of U.S. policy, military policy, in the region going back to the Carter Doctrine of 1979, which really militarized U.S. policy in the region. That said, it seems to me that the emphasis on ensuring access to oil reflects not simply a determination of people in power to enrich their chums. It also reflects the prevailing definition of freedom, of how our fellow citizens define what it means to be free. And that, sadly, that definition tends to take the form of material interests. To be free, we believe, we collectively believe, to be free is to have a car that we can fill with cheap gas so that we can go wherever we want to go when we want to go there. And that, it seems to me, also helps to explain why the United States has gotten itself involved in this misbegotten war in the Persian Gulf. Now, the really interesting part is, of course, here in 2020, guess what? We don't need Persian Gulf oil to maintain the American way of life, but our policy elites haven't quite caught up to that fact. That is to say, they haven't caught up to the fact that in a very concrete sense, the Persian Gulf really doesn't qualify as a vital U.S. national security interest. We need to reevaluate how important that part of the world is to us in substantive terms, and I think if we did so, we'd find that the rationale for maintaining the so-called global war on terrorism would evaporate.
I mean, yeah, what of that? Is that simply, I mean, like, I was aware that we get, you know, a fraction of our domestic oil, or I should say oil that we use domestically from that region. We get most of it from the United States. Well, we could get most of it from the United States. We get Canada, Mexico. We could be perfectly free from that area. And obviously, prices are fixed, you know, globally. But if we really were concerned about it, we could also just nationalize all our own resources and deal with it that way. Is that it, or is part of it also just a desire to control the spigot? On some level, so that our, you know, rivals, China, don't have unfettered access to it.
Well, I think I would have stopped that sentence with the word control. In other words, don't go to the spigot. What I mean by that is there is a mindset within the foreign policy establishment in Washington, dates back to World War II, certainly reinforced by the Cold War, and by the end of the Cold War, an attitude that says we are the global leader. We are somehow called upon to determine the future of global events, and that maintaining a presence, frequently military presence, in many parts of the world is the way we exercise that leadership. And I think you can make a case that during the Cold War, despite many errors along the way, like Vietnam, that there was some merit in that notion or that definition of American global leadership. I think that rationale has evaporated since the end of the Cold War. And this notion that we need to control, for example, the notion that we need to control what goes on in the part of the world inhabited by Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Iran, has simply caused us to make catastrophic mistakes, costly to us, costly to the people that we are supposedly liberating, and there is an enormous stubbornness among elites in Washington to acknowledge the extent to which our policies in that part of the world have yielded a disaster. President Trump said he understood that those policies had led to disaster, said he was going to get us out, and of course he has not done that, and indeed now I think it seems increasingly likely that he is going to replicate the errors in judgment of Obama and of George W. Bush and of Bill Clinton and so on.
I want to get into that no more, but I just also want to touch on maybe the more general aspect of presidential command. You talk about the 11th commandment. You call it the Decalogue plus one or D plus one. Explain that to us and also explain to us whether that comes from there's a quality of like Congress just feeling mentally and emotionally overwhelmed, and they don't want to have to process a lot of the things we just talked about, and so they just defer to the president.
Well, I think that's true. I don't want to be too harsh, but I think that really reflects cowardice on the part of Congress, not a Republican cowardice or a Democratic cowardice, a cowardice that has created an inclination, I should say a disinclination, on the part of the Congress to fulfill its duties under the Constitution. And, of course, the things related to the war powers are a classic example of that. So this deference to the commander-in-chief goes all the way back to World War II and to the earliest days of the Cold War when we persuaded ourselves that we needed to empower the president to blow up the world, you know, to push the button in order to keep ourselves safe. We could have a long argument about whether or not that made sense back in, let's say, 1949 or 1959, but it certainly doesn't make any sense today, and therefore there's an urgent need to curtail the authority of the president to make war. And I think it's only with President Trump and his sort of casual way of making decisions that there is now a much livelier appreciation that this deference to the commander-in-chief really has been a mistake for a long, long time.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think that accounts for that in this day and age? I mean, I agree with you, it's cowardice, but it's also one that seems to be sort of almost distinct of self-preservation. I mean, I'm thinking at least in terms of the Democrats, right? I mean, because I mean, Republicans have not paid a price in supporting. It seems to me now. I guess one could argue that Jeb Bush, you know, paid a price maybe in the last the last Republican primary on some level because of his brother's war of choice. But when I look at Democrats, I see. And maybe this is just my, you know, I'm not quite old enough to remember a time where it was different. But, you know, maybe McGovern still sort of like rules in the heads of Democrats. But, you know, I think of John Kerry and his failure to sort of like follow what I think was his natural inclination to vote against the Iraq War. What accounts for that cowardice? What accounts for that?
Well, you know, if you take responsibility for something, then you're going to be held accountable for what the consequences were. So it's a lot easier to foist the responsibility for making war onto the president. And then if things don't go away, you can go, tut, 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 what a mistake that was. But you don't really own it. I would disagree with you on the fact that prices have been paid. Remember, back in the off-year elections of 2006, the American people did hold George W. Bush responsible and elected a Democratic Congress. And that probably also explains one explanation for why Barack Obama won the presidency in 2008. Yeah. You know, he too, if you remember, was denouncing stupid wars and promising to get out of them.
Fair enough. I mean, I sort of think the 2006 thing in retrospect might have been as much about Mark Foley and sort of the corruption amongst the Republicans. But I like to think part of it was at least anti-war. But so where we have now seen there are war powers, new war powers resolutions. Our acts, I guess, or resolutions based on the act introduced in the Senate by Tim Kaine and in the House by Barbara Lee and Ilhan Omar, that sort of mirror one that Sanders and Khanna had introduced some times back. What is the need for these resolutions? I mean, is it to just sort of like, I don't know, spruce up the marker that theoretically is already there?
I don't know, really. I mean, to some degree, it looks like posturing. You wonder if anything's going to really change. You know, it seems to me that if the Congress genuinely believed that the president was exceeding his authority in making war somewhere, that there is a solution readily available, and that's cut off the funding.
Right.
I mean, the Congress does, you know, the power of the purse is very substantial. But the I think the reflex reaction of the Congress is to say, oh, my God, we don't want to be accused of not supporting the troops. And therefore, they continue to fund wars even when a majority of members have concluded that the war is a stupid one. And therefore, the authority of the commander-in-chief to do whatever he wants remains intact.
And of course, though, you know, we have now a precedent of the president moving funds from, you know, to appropriating yeah. funds for the
yep.
wall in
on
this
wall,
instance.
Huh? Yep.
I mean,
yep.
if he can,
I think it would be constitutionally complicated and controversial. I'm not trying to say that power of the purse equals, you know, we can shut off a war between now and next Thursday. But it does seem to me that ultimately that defines the authority of the Congress. And indeed, you know, the framers of the Constitution believed that our system of three co-equal branches of government, that nonetheless, that, you know, the first among the equals in their judgment was the Congress. That's why it's Article 1 of the Constitution describes the role of the Congress. It's only Article 2 that gets to talking about what the president can and cannot do.
I mean, what do you make of... I mean, I wonder how much sort of there are more culprits in this day and age when, you know, I don't know, is it 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, we get all of this, you know, this trove of information on Afghanistan that basically says
yeah.
we as a country have been lied to by our leaders for yeah. 15 years, 16, you know, like I'm trying to be generous and not say the entire 18. I mean, nobody's talking about it.
I must say, one of the things that I'm most disappointed about, there was a big flurry of interest when the Washington Post broke the story of the Afghanistan papers. I think that lasted about 72 hours.
Yeah.
And it quickly began to fade away. Because, I think you're exactly right here, that trove of documents indicts the entire national security apparatus. Democrats, Republicans, senior military officers, there was a pattern, probably continues to be a pattern, of deception and dishonesty. We were lied to. How could that have happened? Well, I mean, again, as I think there's a short version of the story and the long version. I think the long version is more important, and that is that going back to World War II and through the Cold War, the American people came to believe that the experts, whether they were people working in the White House or they were generals working in the Pentagon, that the experts had the best interests of the country at heart, and they knew what they were doing, that they were competent. You know, I'm a sort of Vietnam-era guy, and if there's anything we should have learned from Vietnam is that the people who were supposedly smarter than the rest of us weren't smarter. I mean, the people who blundered into Vietnam, the people who insisted upon continuing that war long after it became apparent that it was an act of folly. They got away with it. I mean, we're talking about the McNamaras and the McGeorge Bundys and the William Westmorelands and on and on. One might have thought that the Vietnam War would have created a sense of skepticism in the American public about and an unwillingness to defer and to trust to people who claim to be experts, but that if that skepticism existed, it faded away quickly.
Where did it? I mean, it seems to have faded away from every possible sector that it could have existed. I mean, on some level, I would have imagined the skepticism would have been most institutionalized within the context of the military on some level. Maybe I don't know. I have no experience within that institution, but at least there's like some type of framework, right? Presumably where there's institutional memory. But I just watched a clip today of Mark Milley, who is the, as you know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying, I don't believe really any of the stuff in those Afghanistan papers because it would involve some type of like broad conspiracy, when to me, it would all just have to be that everybody agrees we're just going to be cowardly and do exactly what you had just mentioned earlier, which is not be the thumb that sticks out and tell the truth.
Well, I think, you know, the military is a hierarchy, and in any hierarchy, there are incentives to play along so that you can make your way up toward the top of the greasy pole. Military service does not encourage original thinking. It tends to demand conformity. And I think that, you know, it's the younger officers who very interestingly, are the ones who have the critical take on Afghanistan or Iraq. It's the senior officers who say, geez, I didn't see anything wrong. We're a bunch of smart guys doing the best we can. So that's part of the problem, I think.
Well, where do you think this, I mean, we are on the verge of perhaps, and I don't know, I mean, if you have an assessment that is, you know, I'd be curious as to your assessment as to what is actually going on with this assassination. And I noticed you called it an assassination of Soleimani. What is your assessment of it? I mean, you know, I've heard differing theories that just this has been a long-term project for Pompeo and having Milley in there and Espers, who is a Raytheon executive, they were, you know, there was a sort of a unified front in pushing this. Or I've also heard theories that maybe this was a mistake and they didn't realize that Soleimani was there and they were just going after Mohandes, I think, who was the Iraqi militia leader who was part of the incursion to the U.S. embassy. What is your assessment of what's happening there and of the ability of what the agenda is of the White of the administration really here?
Well, first of all, I don't know. But my guess is that in these kind of matters, the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they're going to go into the Oval Office. They're going to say, Mr. President, we think we need to act. And here are the five options that we recommend you consider. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Typically, it's the middle one. It's the one that's not too hot or not too cold that the bureaucracy wants the president to choose. I think in this case, he surprised everybody by choosing the one that was way too hot. Neither the president nor his advisors had thought through about consequences. What happens next? Where does this leave us? How does this somehow advance the well-being of our country? So they killed this guy, and in doing so, of course, they surrendered the initiative to the Iranian government to decide what's going to happen next. And here we are waiting with bated breath to find out how Iran is going to react. I mean, they have reacted to some degree, condemnation, pulling out of what remained of the Iran nuclear deal. There was a broad expectation that there's going to be some kind of violent act. I don't know if that's going to be the case. My own guess would be that there will be, but it won't be direct. The Iranians are not stupid. They're not going to sort of directly attack the United States or even U.S. forces. They're going to launch an attack that is indirect or oblique, or maybe an attack in which their own role will be somewhat disguised, and therefore it'll be create complications for Bush and his advisors, Trump and his advisors, in trying to figure out how to formulate a response. And they don't need to do it tomorrow. I mean, the initiative is theirs. They can wait patiently. They can calculate, which President Bush does not do, and come up with the answer that they think makes sense. Doesn't mean it's going to be a good answer, a sensible answer. But you know, we're sort of in the wait and see mode now, I think.
What do you make of Mike Pence coming out and saying that Suleiman helped 10 of the men who would carry out the 9/11 attacks? I mean,
I think there's no evidence to support that. Just like there's no evidence to support his claim with the Iraqi parliament having said they want U.S. forces out of the country. Pence goes on TV and says, I know that the Iraqi people want us to stay. I mean, the arrogance is breathtaking.
Well, it seems to me that it's worse than there's no evidence of that. There's, you know, we have a 9/11 report. To the extent that we have evidence, we have all the evidence points in the other direction. I mean, it'd be one thing, you know, to say, like, I think the Iraqi people want X, Y, or Z, and we haven't taken a poll. But if we had a dozen polls that said the Iraqi people want A, and I say they want B, I don't know. It seems to me he's lying. He's just lying.
I think that's an accurate characterization. Yeah.
Let me just ask you one final question here. They go in and they present Donald Trump with the, you know, here's the five options. Is there nobody in this process who is like, and here's the, you know, two paragraphs we've written on the implications of these choices or what we would do afterwards? Like, is it just, here's the way that we can react? Is there nobody who's presenting him with like, and incidentally, this is the logical sort of next steps that happen if we act that way?
Yeah, normally there would be. Doesn't mean that the analysis would necessarily be sound, but there would be analysis. As best we can tell as outsiders, you know, outside observers, right. It doesn't appear that that's the way this president operates. In other words, he's not interested in some subordinate's ideas of how a particular action could play out. He's a gut level kind of guy. You know, he operates on instinct and on impulse, and that's his MO. And I think it's exceedingly dangerous. But I don't know that anybody has found a way to curtail that inclination on his part.
Lastly, you know, this has been something, I mean, you've obviously been thinking about these questions for a long time, and been talking about it and writing about them. Is there one element of society that's going to have to sort of, lead this charge? Is there one that's uniquely situated? Like, how do we get out of this, seemingly never ending, I guess, progression through this sort of never ending war?
Well, it's got to be the American people. And that's not going to be the Washington establishment. It's not going to be the military. It's going to say, hey, wait a second. We now realize we've been going in the wrong direction and we want to change course radically. And in many respects, I believe, in my book, I argue that the 2016 election was, in fact, a repudiation of those stupid ideas that shaped U.S. policy during the post-Cold War era. Remember, particularly on the matter of war, that candidate Trump said, yes, our never-ending wars are stupid. Elect me. I will end them. And I think that was a major factor in why he got elected in the first place. Sadly, he has not been able to follow through on what he promised, and I think he hasn't in large part because he doesn't know how. I mean, he is not capable of sophisticated analysis. Careful follow through. And so we get decisions like this one to assassinate the Iranian general, and then we all sit around trying to figure out what the consequences are.
Is there a candidate today that you see that may be running that represents a similar opportunity, but maybe one that's not as devoid of any capacity to execute?
You know, I don't think I'm in a position to evaluate all the Democratic challengers. I mean, I'm just sort of amazed that there's so many of them that are still in the race that the Democrats haven't been able to reduce the field down to, you know, two or three. Where then we could kind of make that careful examination of the individual's ability to, you know, think, the individual's temperament, I just don't think we're there yet, and I say that with great regret.
You don't think Sanders represents that? I mean, at the very least, in the context of this attack on Suleiman, and broadly speaking, I mean, to the extent that there has been a, you know, I mean, he's introduced. We have five senators running in the race, or at one point we did, and they all had the opportunity to introduce a war powers resolution. Sanders was the only one who did it.
Hey, going back to 2016, when he was challenging Hillary Clinton, it was clear that his approach to using military power was going to be far more prudent and reasoned than was Hillary Clinton's. And so in that sense, yeah, I think many of the things that Senator Sanders says is they make sense to me. But I frankly don't know if he's electable, and that's not my call anyway. So we'll just see how that plays out.
Indeed. Andrew Bacevich, the book is The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There you have it. We are, you know, and I think we had talked about this on Friday. We're just basically waiting to see what Iran decides to do, and then we get a better notion of just how, you know, what the intentions of the Trump administration are. And I don't even know if there is a unified. I don't even know if like you can say that any more than you could say like what are the intentions of a monkey? Honestly, like there could be certain reactions in the moment, but to say that there's a cohesive plan here seems unlikely. And we're gonna hear from some of the Iranian leadership in a moment. We have some video. We'll play that in the fun half. That's what you want to do.
It's fun, actually.
It's super fun stuff. But, you know, the thing is
responsible, reasoned leadership that a lot of people have been looking for.
Well, in many respects, I mean, it sounds facetious, but it's not. And they are, and if their actions are consistent with their rhetoric, they understand what they're dealing with and who they're dealing with. And they know specifically they're dealing with the president, that there is no, this is not 2002. There has not been a, the country is not in a state of shock following a major terrorist attack. There has not been a 18-month program of demonizing Iran and justifying an attack on them. And so they know that their competition is really just about a half a dozen people in the White House. And it's quite possible they understand that, like, if we hold off a couple of months, this ain't going to help Trump in terms of impeachment. I mean, they must be aware. There's no reason why they can't. If they had their own little majority report, they'd be right now going like, he's probably doing this just to, you know, get the impeachment off his back. And Pompeo's pushing it because he's a lunatic. And Esper's, you know, got his stock options haven't vested yet. And Raytheon, I mean, whatever it is.
I didn't keep track of it, but I missed there was a Twitter thread where a guy said, you know, I'm on an Acela to D.C. And there are literally guys in the cafe car doing their pitches for defense contracts.
Right.
Like they're, I mean,
of
people should not
were.
Forget the very, you know, crude version of all the stuff that goes on with this.
But I mean, if I'm in Iran and I'm thinking like, we're going to hit them, but let's wait a month or 2 months, see if Nancy Pelosi doesn't bring those, you know, holds off on those articles of impeachment. Because, I mean, really, in many respects, if you wanted to do damage to Trump and you knew that was basically what you were doing, that's what you would do.
And to be clear, but, hit them. I mean, we'll see. But in this case, I would honestly 100%. I believe the supreme leader, which is like a funny translation, but they are not, when they say hit us, they're not talking about, you know, this Bill de Blasio nonsense about New York is on high alert. You're talking about, you know, Straits of Hormuz.
Well,
Pakistan, we'll get to it, but that's just important to clarify that. And just really quick, going back to 2002, there was an open doorway with Iran. They helped us in the initial stages because they loathed the Taliban. And a lot of people today who make a living on freaking out about Donald Trump's Twitter threat are precisely the people that smacked them in the face with the Axis of Evil speech when we could have had a full rapprochement with them.
There's an easier way of saying that, David Frum.
David Frum. Well, there are other people besides David Frum, but he did happen to literally write that speech.
Yeah. Right.
And General Soleimani was also involved in the coordination in Afghanistan.
And also been fighting ISIS, which apparently was, up until a couple of days ago, a very big priority for us.
Well, that's one of the reasons he has some popularity in Iraq.
So considering what we know about Iran's relationship to Trump, impeachment, et cetera, do you think that it's possible that, say, a truly anti-imperialist candidate gets elected president and could reverse this, or will it be too late?
I think Weigel himself said, I was very anti-war, so this could help Bernie there.
I think it helps.
Well, that's the thing. Helps Bernie. I think it helps Biden and Bernie, because anybody who is interested in sort of like the traditional take on war, I think, looks at Buttigieg, maybe they're with Warren, or maybe they're with Buttigieg or whoever it is, and they say, well, I'm going to go with the real deal, and that is Joe Biden.
They know me.
On
that. He's going to punch Iran in the face.
But I imagine there are some people who support even Biden and Buttigieg and Warren, who are like, wait, this is a total mess up. And there's such a clear choice, it seems to me, between, in terms of like perspective on this. And if you want one, then I think you go to Biden. If you want the other, you go to Bernie. So I think they're both going to benefit from this.
I think you're right.
And everybody else is. Now, I don't know that they're going to benefit equally. I don't know.
My question was, would they be able to reverse it, though, if the war machine has already been started? Like, would they be able to get us out of a conflict with Iran?
I don't know.
I mean, we don't. Yeah, it's such a long. It's such a long period of time. It's such a long period of time. But like, if they went in, all things being equal, as of the situation as it is now, yes, they could, because there's not really that many things that they would need to do to cool that situation. And I'm not convinced that this isn't the type of situation that there's plenty of really crazy people that want this, but there's some people in that same establishment, for lack of a better word, that understand that this is incredibly stupid.
Oh, and we should just add, because this came up, Jamie, you brought this up the other day on Friday, that Bernie Sanders has received more money from military personnel, that, you know, the actual soldiers or airmen and Marines or sea people, I guess you should call them now, air people. And I was wondering if it was just within the context of the Democratic primary, and apparently it's not.
No.
Apparently it was Bernie Sanders comes in more than doubles his nearest rival is Pete Buttigieg, and then Donald Trump, who of course was did go to a military boarding school, so that would explain that.
And is a unofficial CIA operation.
All right, quick.
Yeah, that doesn't count as CIA totals.
Yeah, does that? What about CIA contributions?
Deep
Buttigieg
state,
and
deep
Trump.
State.
Yeah,
deep like state contributions, yeah. Folks. Just a reminder. It is your support that makes this show possible. We cannot do it without you. You can support the show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, not only do we give you the free show, free of commercials, but we also give you extra content every day. And you're helping us build things like the AM Quickie, which thousands of you enjoy now. We would love more of you to check it out so that we can start to pay for it. But it's really, in many respects, our members who support that experiment. We're going to try it for another, extended period of time, see if it can catch fire and at the very least, you know, support what we're doing here. But you as a member make that possible. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, subscribe. That apparently is a good thing to do. You can also go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. And don't forget that AM Quickie, it's available on our app. You can go to majorityapp.com, get the app. You can IM the show via the app. You can call the show via the app. And you have the AM Quickie at your fingertips by just clicking on that AMQ tab in the app. You'll see it when we get there. Or you can just subscribe to AM Quickie through amquickie.com. Today is Monday. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Michael, what is on the deck?
Docket. Drew Mikhael, who is a fellow at Queen's University, who does a lot of work in conflict zones and particular amount of time in Lebanon, is going to be talking about the escalation against Iran, and then following up the show we did on Friday, which focused on all of the dynamics arising out of the assassination. Specifically, Drew and I are going to look at how the spillover effect will impact the emerging social movements that we saw in the Middle East over the past several months, particularly in Lebanon, but also Iraq and Iran, and maybe also talk about Turkey's deploying troops to Libya, and they're going to be fighting an enhanced proxy war with Russia. So that's another one that we'll keep a little bit of an eye on. Matt Crisman is also going to join us, a whole bunch of other stuff. I also just real quick want to add February 7th, Bell House live show, grab your tickets. And apropos of today's show, the last illicit history documentary we did for patrons was on the history of the RAND Corporation, which is sort of a good light on how the types of intelligence establishment that Basevich was talking about was formed after World War II and the thinking that went into it. So patreon.com/TMBS or tmbs.fm to get everything.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, I barely remember what's in this episode because we recorded it before the break and my mind's been erased. But I do remember thinking that we did a good job. We did an episode called I Love the 2010s, where we recapped an entire decade for a massive three-parter with a very funny Jake Flores and Simone Norman as guests helping us out. I do recall...
Sounds like a corrective to a VH1 show.
Indeed. I mean, I don't love the 2010s. I think the title was meant to be a little bit ironic on our part. It's just so much crap. But there's some good stuff in there, too. We talked about Occupy Wall Street, the Arab Spring, Witch House and C-Punk, you know... Cultural milestones and the fappening, and somehow tie it all together. So check that out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt.
Coming up on Literary Hangover, I'm going to be reading a poem tomorrow. I'm not going to be here, actually. So The Sotweed Factor by Ebenezer Cook, a 1708 poem about how Americans are all sort of like cheating tobacco farmers and illiterate judges and stuff like that. A lot of timeless lessons, actually.
Is that what you do on your day off? You go home, you read
it. I read poetry.
You read poetry.
I recite it actually into my microphone. Yeah, so, and among some other things. So, yeah, that'll be out. The recording of the poem will be out this week, and then a new episode will be out on the weekend.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.